Blog Talk Radio. You're listening to The Conservative Cauldron, Bewitching Radio.
Come out here to this office where I've been many times before, and I come out here today to apologize to the people of New Jersey. I apologize to the people of Fort Lee, and I apologize to the members of the state legislature. I am embarrassed and humiliated by the conduct of some of the people on my team. There's no doubt in my mind that the conduct that they exhibited is completely unacceptable and showed a lack of respect for their appropriate role of government. This morning, I've terminated the employment of Bridget Kelly, effective immediately. I terminated her employment because she lied to me. I have and will continue to, started yesterday, to once again now have personal one-on-one discussions myself with the remaining members of my senior staff to determine if there's any other information that I do not know and need to know in order to take appropriate action. I am heartbroken that someone who I permitted to be in that circle of trust for the last 5 years betrayed my trust. But I don't want any of you to confuse what I'm saying this morning. Ultimately, I am responsible. Let me tell you, everybody, I was blindsided yesterday morning. I had no knowledge or involvement in this issue, in its planning or its execution, and I am stunned by the abject stupidity that was shown here.
Good Friday evening, people. You are listening live to the new and improved, see, I'm so excited I can hardly spit it out, the new and improved Conservative Cauldron Radio. I'm your host, Becky Noble. I want to thank everybody for checking in and hanging out with me tonight. That's right, we are new and improved, people. This is a one full solid hour of Conservative Cauldron Radio, and this is the first one. I'm really pumped, and I'm really excited, and I'm really glad that everybody could be here. I'm really glad that everyone has been able to dig themselves out of the frozen tundra. That's pretty much what we've been up to here this week in St. Louis. For anybody who's listening somewhere other than St. Louis, we got about, some of us got up to about a foot of snow. And while for some people, you know, that's kind of a, hey, you know, put your shorts on kind of weather. And yeah, we get some snow here in St. Louis, you know, and we've gotten some hefty snow amounts here, but a foot of snow doesn't happen every other day here. So, you know, we were a little panicky. We were a little shaky here. And also anyone who was in a grocery store last weekend, the Saturday before the storm hit, can probably attest to the shakiness and the scariness of people in the grocery store. But that is over with. We've got some better weather coming on, and we have dug out of the frozen tundra, and here we are. That, of course, was New Jersey Governor Chris Christie this week on, I guess, probably is what is going to be called Traffic Gate or Bridge Gate in New Jersey right now. For those of you who are not very familiar with this story, and it really, it's blown up really quickly here this week, and I think there are several reasons why. We're going to get into that. And there are also several reasons that were this not Chris Christie, nobody would know what the hell is going on here, and we'll get into that too. But like I said, for anybody who doesn't know the story here, in September of, I guess, yeah, that's right, because New Jersey had a special election to reelect Governor Christie. Back in September of 2013, the Christie campaign was looking for endorsements from various people around the state, and most governors do it. They're looking for endorsements. They're looking for endorsements basically from both parties, you know, from state reps, state senators, prominent mayors, you know, anyone like that, and anyone in the political circle. They like to have as many endorsements as possible, and an endorsement from Fort Lee, New Jersey Mayor Mark Sokolich was being sought, and for whatever reason or other, maybe for the fact that Mark Sokolich is a Democrat in a pretty blue state, Mayor Sokolich did not choose to endorse Chris Christie in the gubernatorial election. And so not too long after that, there was a huge traffic snafu on the George Washington Bridge up there. And what that is basically, the George Washington Bridge, and I don't know myself, so if I say anything incorrect here, you know, anyone please can feel free to call in and help me explain this. And if I get it wrong, you can certainly correct me. The George Washington Bridge is one of the biggest throughways I know, at least in the nation. It is a major, major artery between New Jersey and New York City. And what happened was two lanes of this bridge were blocked off back in September, actually on the first day of school. A lot of kids were going back to school that first day. And long story short, there was some major, major traffic hang-ups and some major traffic headaches on the George Washington Bridge that day. It went on for quite a few days, and there were people who were stuck on that bridge waiting in traffic for some people between 4 to 6 hours. And there was a lot of first responders, it was reported, that could not get through to get where they needed to go to help people. There was one story that a 91-year-old woman had died while she was waiting for first responders to get to her. Her daughter has since come forth and said, no, that is not true. But Governor Christie had a 107-minute-long press conference yesterday, I believe, where he basically he apologized. He apologized to the people of New Jersey. He apologized specifically to the people of Fort Lee, New Jersey. He even apologized to the legislature, which I thought was kind of a classy move. And some people in his administration have been shown the door. His deputy chief of staff, Bridget Kelly, her behavior he called stupid and deceitful. She was immediately let go. He also asked a two-time campaign manager, Bill Stepien, I'm probably not pronouncing this right, to also step down. He was also acting as a consultant to the Republican Governors Association. Governor Christie is the chairman of that association. And he also asked Mr. Stepien to withdraw his name from consideration to lead the New Jersey State Republican Party. And, you know, right after this happened, I saw Bernie Goldberg this evening say something that is probably truer than we all know, and that is that one of the big reasons, and like I said, there are several, one of the biggest reasons that this story is as big a story as it is that a lot of journalists who work in the mainstream media, and they work in Manhattan, they work in New York City, those journalists live in New Jersey. And in order to get to work in Manhattan, they have to take that bridge over to New York City. And if there are huge traffic problems on that bridge, well, that affects them, and therefore it's a big story. And but, you know, there was a couple things here that jumped out at me that during this press conference, Chris Christie, one of the first things he mentioned was the fact that some staffers had been let go. Some heads rolled and people lost their jobs. And, you know, I think for a lot of us, there was an immediate comparison to President Obama and the scandal plagued administration that we have in Washington, D.C. compared to Governor Christie's administration. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say that they are obviously not perfect people. But, you know, one of the first things he said was that he had fired some people. And I think for a lot of us, we were kind of like, hey, that's a little refreshing. Some people were held accountable. Some people were told, hey, your behavior is unacceptable and you got to go. And so that's what he did. By all accounts, Chris Christie is a no-nonsense guy. Some would say that he runs a tight ship there in New Jersey, almost to the point of, you know, I think the mainstream media, well, we all know they love to portray him as Tony Soprano. And, you know, maybe he, in his, the way he runs his administration, you know, I mean, people do what works for him. And if he is a little heavy-handed at times, if that's what needs to be done, and especially in a case like this. So I think that was kind of pleasantly surprising for a lot of people, was that some heads actually rolled. And another thing, too, was that, you know, one of the things really that stood out to me was that this investigation has been going on for quite some time. And as Governor Christie was giving his press conference, United States Attorney in New Jersey was already beginning a preliminary inquiry here. And the investigation into this started almost immediately. I think, you know, Democrats in New Jersey, he's a Republican governor in a very, very blue state. And so, you know, Democrats are smelling blood in the water. And this whole investigation has immediately got underway. And of course, the mainstream media ran with it too, and I think for a lot of us, one of the first things that we thought of was, you know, they jumped on this, they were on this like white on rice, and wouldn't it have been how refreshing and how pleasantly surprising it would have been had these same media people, had they jumped on stories like, oh, I don't know, Benghazi, where we have four dead Americans. How about Fast and Furious, where we have a dead border agent and we have hundreds of dead Mexican citizens? Or how about the IRS scandal, where innocent Americans were targeted simply for their beliefs and simply for groups that they belong to? How refreshing that would be had they been that quick to jump on stories such as that. And I think, too, one of the things for me also is that when Governor Christie, when he immediately began his press conference, within a couple of minutes, and we just heard it there, he said, I'm responsible. These are people who are my employees. These are people who I appointed to do jobs to assist me in my administration, and they screwed up, and because of that, A, they have to go, and B, they have to go because I am responsible. The buck stops with me. And I think that was also equally refreshing for people, you know, to hear a politician on of any party, be it Democrat or Republican, hear them say, I'm responsible, because let's face it, you can probably, what, count on the fingers of one hand these days how many politicians are going to come forward, regardless of what's been done or said or not done or not said, and say, hey, I'm responsible. The buck stops with me. For myself, I found that extremely refreshing. I have never been a huge Chris Christie fan, and one of the other reasons, too, I think that this story was ginned up and it got so big so fast was because we all know that perhaps Governor Christie has some presidential perspirations. He's in a lot of polls already, and it's a long time out from 2016. Already in a lot of polls, he's the front runner. And, you know, people will rattle off the usual names besides Chris Christie. They'll rattle off Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush. You know, pick your favorite. There's a gajillion names that will be rattled off after Chris Christie's, but in a lot of polls already, he is the front runner. And I don't think that we have to guess who the front runner for the Democrats is. And so that's yet another reason why the mainstream media jumped all over Chris Christie, because usually he's their go-to Republican guy because he's not too Republican for them. And they can go to him and they can expect him to be a little blunt and to be a little brusque and to give them that Tony Soprano thing that they really want to bring out about him and portray him as. But if the mainstream media thought for one nanosecond that they need to protect Hillary Clinton, they're going to do it. And if that means that by protecting Hillary Clinton that they can make Chris Christie look bad, all bets are off, and they're going to do that in a heartbeat. And so that in a nutshell is why it has gotten so big and so quickly. And incidentally, too, the United States Attorney for New Jersey, he is a guy named Paul Fishman. And, well, there's probably a few things that most people, even if you've heard about this story but you've not heard all the ins and outs and all the details of it, Paul Fishman is a huge Obama supporter and donated large sums of money to the Obama campaign. He is also a large Democratic Party donor. So here's the thing. You have this investigation that had already started prior to the press conference yesterday, and the investigation is being led by a guy like Paul Fishman, a guy who, by all accounts, is described as a huge Barack Obama supporter and a huge donor to the Democrat Party. So that will probably be very interesting to see just how this is handled and how, to coin a phrase, how fair and balanced this investigation will be. The Democrats also in the New Jersey legislature, they claim to have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of additional documents that they are going to release, and apparently they're rubbing their hands together in the hopes that this is just going to get worse for Governor Christie. And, you know, bottom line, if right now I don't think that we don't have any reason to believe that he is lying. If it comes forth, if there's emails, if there's audio tape, if there's anything, any shred of evidence that comes forth that might insinuate that he did know something about it, then that's a game changer, and this whole thing will turn completely on its head, and, you know, we'll see where it goes from there. But for myself, and I think for a lot of other people, just you know, watching this press conference yesterday, I think that Chris Christie handled it pretty well. I think he has handled it as best he can. He's been classy about it. He has stated what he knows, what he doesn't know. And, you know, I think right now we don't have any reason to believe that he is not telling the truth. You know, that can change. That can change in a heartbeat. And we will see. We'll see where that leads to. And we'll see what Paul Fishman and his Democratic buds, what they dig up. But so there was that. Also this week, And a lot of people, maybe, I know at least people my age, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty. And kind of started back in 1964 during the Lyndon Johnson administration. And on January 8th of that year, he used his State of the Union address to announce this War on Poverty. And now we're looking at it 50 years later, and a lot of people this week, I've heard a lot of commentators, a lot of pundits, a lot of talking heads on TV have asked, you know, where are we in this war on poverty? And you know, 50 years later, I'm not sure that we have a whole lot to show for it. According to, I have a paper here written by Robert Rector of the Heritage Foundation. There's some pretty startling statistics here. It says that 50 years later, after the war on poverty was begun, that 15% of Americans still live in poverty. And that is according to the official census poverty report for 2012. And that is basically unchanged since the mid-1960s. Liberals will always argue, of course, that you're not spending enough money on this program or that program, but you know, we have thrown basically. Here's a few more stats. The federal government currently runs more than 80 means-tested welfare programs that provide cash, food, housing, medical care, and targeted social services to poor and low-income Americans. And in 2012, which is the last year that they have any sort of data for such things, the government spent $916 billion on these 80-some-odd programs. And roughly 100 million Americans receive aid from at least one of these programs. And that is an average cost of $9,000 per recipient. This figure doesn't include Social Security benefits or Medicare benefits. And back in 1964, Lyndon Johnson promised, you know, we've heard the word promise batted around a whole lot this week, haven't we? But back in 1964, Lyndon Johnson promised that this war on poverty would be an investment. But so far, the United States has invested $20 trillion. If we can get our heads around that number, if we can all stop for a minute and take a deep breath and have a little cleansing and a little aura checking in with about that number, $20.7 trillion, not billion, trillion, and that was in 2011, from the beginning of the war on poverty. I'm sorry, I don't want to confuse anyone here. From the beginning of the war on poverty in 1964 up until 2011. The United States has spent $20.7 trillion in the war on poverty. And this paper by Robert Rector of the Heritage Foundation also goes on to say that poor people in America are not the same as they were 50 years ago. It says here that Americans who live below the poverty level right now are as of last year, as of 2013, Americans who live below the poverty level live in a house or an apartment that is in decent shape, that is in good repair. It is equipped with air conditioning and cable TV. The average person who is, by all criteria, governmental criteria, is classified as poor in this country. His home is larger than the home of the average non-poor French, German, or English citizen. I'll say that again. People who are classified by governmental standards and by governmental criteria in this country, people who are classified as poor, their homes are larger than the average non-poor, someone who is not classified as poor in France, Germany, or England. He has a car. He has multiple color TVs and a DVD player. More than half the poor have computers, and a third have wide, flat-screen TVs. The overwhelming majority of poor Americans are not undernourished and did not suffer from hunger for even one day of the previous year. And that's interesting because that's actually, just the opposite. There's been study after study after study done on obesity and overweight Americans, and the majority of them are low income. And that's actually kind of sad, because what it says is that people who maybe are using food stamps and they try to stretch their food dollar as best they can, those people are buying a lot of junk food, because junk food is cheaper than buying fruits and vegetables and healthy food. So that really, it's sad. It's a sad commentary on, or at least one of the sad commentaries on our society today. And, you know, a lot of these things are root causes, too, like fractured families, people who are not participating in the work, really who are, and here's another thing, too, is that there are so many, you hear cases all the time of people who will tell you that they're making more money on unemployment than even if they worked at a part-time job. So there's people who are not participating in the workforce, and a large segment of the population who is classified as poor is now less capable of being self-sufficient than when the war on poverty began. The collapse of marriage in low-income communities has also played a huge role in this. The out-of-wedlock birth rate, you know, you can go on and on and on, you know, with the statistics of this. But, you know, and a lot of times, too, people like to think that that Republicans don't have a solution and don't have answers to this problem. Earlier this week, President Obama, which ironically enough it was on the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty, President Obama announced on Thursday that they were setting up promise zones. And there are 5 different zones here around the country that have been designated as promise zones. They are the cities of San Antonio, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, portions of southeastern Kentucky, which ironically enough are many of them are coal mining communities, and the last one was the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. And I wrote about poverty on Indian reservations a few weeks back on Conservative Cauldron blog. If you go to any Indian reservation around the nation, the poverty that you will see there is very stark, and it's very eye-opening, and it's very sad, because these are very proud people. You know, we can rehash American history all day long, but, you know, they're proud people with a proud history, and some of the things that they have been reduced to, some of the situations, the poverty situations that they have been reduced to is... It shouldn't be happening to anyone in this country. It shouldn't be happening to any American. Florida Senator Marco Rubio was on Fox and Friends earlier this week, and he was talking about, well, first of all, let's listen to Barack Obama a few weeks ago, before this rollout of the poverty zones. He made a speech on income inequality.
So the basic bargain at the heart of our economy has frayed. In fact, this trend towards growing inequality is not unique to America's market economy. Across the developed world, inequality has increased. Some of you may have seen just last week, the Pope himself spoke about this at eloquent length. How can it be, he wrote, that it's not a news item when an elderly homeless person dies of exposure, but it is news when the stock market loses 2 points. But this increasing inequality is most pronounced in our country. And it challenges the very essence of who we are as a people. I believe this is the defining challenge of our time. And the idea that so many children are born into poverty in the wealthiest nation on earth is heartbreaking enough. But the idea that a child may never be able to escape that poverty because she lacks a decent education or health care, or a community that views her future as their own, that should offend all of us. And it should compel us to action. We are a better country than this.
You know, the fact that President Obama would say that because of someone's zip code or the circumstances of their birth, that he implies, in just that one little clip, he implies that there's no room for movement out of that economic out of that class, out of that economic rung that person was born into. And that's not what America is about. It's not what America is. And quite frankly, it's completely untrue that child is going to stay in that same economic situation forever and ever. I'm going to take a short break here. And when I get back, we are going to listen to Senator Marco Rubio from Florida. Like I said, he was on Fox and Friends this week and had kind of a response to President Obama's economic income inequality, easy for me to say, income inequality speech. So hang on, everybody. Stay right there. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back. I am so glad everybody is here tonight, hanging out and chilling with me. You're listening to Conservative Cauldron Radio. I'm Becky Noble. Be back in a sec.
How lucky can one guy be? I kissed her and she kissed me. Like the fella once said, ain't that a kick in the head? The room was completely black. I hugged her and she hugged back. Like the sailor said, quote, ain't that a hole in a boat? My head keeps spinning. I go to sleep and keep grinning. If this is just the beginning, my life is gonna be beautiful. I've sunshine enough to spread. It's just like the fella said. Tell me quick, ain't love a kick in the head? Like the fella once said, ain't that a kick in the head? The sailor said, quote, ain't that a hole in a boat? My head keeps spinning. I go to sleep and keep grinning. If this is just the beginning, my life is gonna be beautiful. She's telling me we'll be wed. She's picked out a king-size bed. I couldn't feel any better, or I'd be sick. Tell me quick, boy, ain't love a kick. Tell me quick, ain't love a kick in the head.
And we're back. You're listening to Conservative Cauldron Radio. I'm your host, Becky Noble, at the new and improved, now hour-long Conservative Cauldron Radio. This is our first hour-long installment. I am totally psyched and totally pumped, having a blast. I am so glad that everybody is here chilling and hanging out with me. I did forget to say TGIF, so I'm going to say it, TGIF. I'm sure we are all of that all of that thought, all of that TGIF Friday process. Anyway, we've been talking about Chris Christie and his traffic problems. This is just the beginning of that. We will definitely be hearing more about that. We're talking about the 50-year war on poverty here, the anniversary this week of Lyndon Johnson's State of the Union address in 1964, where he first introduced the war on poverty, air quotes, war on poverty. And President Obama gave a speech a few weeks ago before the rollout of these promise zones around various parts of the country, a couple of urban areas, a couple of rural areas, that are going to be targeted economically. And you know, a lot of times the president and his peeps, the people in his party, like to, you know, they like to say that. Well, you know, first of all, we already know, we've already established that Republicans want dirty air and dirty water, and we hate little kids and old people, and, you know, the whole song and dance. And because of all of that, we want everybody to be poor except us. And, you know, we always blame people for their own poverty and things like that, you know. But Florida Senator Marco Rubio was on Fox and Friends earlier this week, and he had kind of a response to the president's speech.
Let's just move to something else you're talking about and kind of leading the way. The president's coming talking about promise zones and talking about the war on poverty and reenacting it. He's going to formalize it on the State of the Union address. You're ahead of the game because you have your own war on poverty. You have a different approach to it. What is it?
Well, the president's focused on income inequality, the difference between the rich and the poor and the gap that's grown. That's the wrong focus. It doesn't give you a complete picture. The issue is not whether the cashier at Burger King makes less than the CEO. The issue is whether that cashier gets stuck being a cashier for 5, 10, 15, 20 years and can't move up. And that's what we should be focused on, the fact that many people are not getting ahead. And there's a lot of different factors behind that. And my proposal is this. The current government programs that are designed to address poverty, they help alleviate some of the pain of poverty, but they do not help people emerge from it. They do not help people rise above it. We have got to deal with that. And with opportunity inequality, not just income inequality, the president's got the wrong focus. So in my mind, we should turn these programs over to states so that they can come up with innovations about how to deal with this. That's really where I think we're going to get the innovations, like we did with welfare reform in the 90s.
Yeah. Regarding, you know, income inequality, and we've heard a burst of this out of nowhere in the last week or two, because it looks like that's going to be the focus of the people across the aisle, the Democrats, there in Washington, because they think this is something they can win with in November. Meanwhile, your side says, let's keep reminding people about Obamacare. This has been a gigantic mess, and they should be held accountable. Is that accurate?
Well, I think that they desperately are looking to ways to change the conversation away from Obamacare. They will not be able to do that because everyday people are dealing with everyday consequences of Obamacare. And so it's just happening in the real world. There's no way to avoid it. I do think the issue of opportunity inequality is a real issue in America, and it's something we need to gap. Income inequality maybe give us an opportunity to talk about what the real problem is. But if the president's proposal for dealing with this problem is raising the minimum wage and taxing rich people, that's a solution to what he called the defining issue of our time. That's not a solution. That's the same tired, stale rhetoric and policies that have failed for 50 years.
You know, Senator Rubio is right, because that's a whole nother, it's a whole nother side of the coin. And, you know, I think we all have to keep in mind here that it's 2014, and 2014 is an election year, and it's a midterm election year. And we all know that When it comes to election years, the more free stuff that Democrats and liberals can promise people, you know, the way they think that they're going to get the vote. And, you know, he's also exactly right in the fact that this whole income inequality thing is they're hoping that what's going to happen here is that it's going to turn the focus from Obamacare, and people are all of a sudden going to start hating rich people because they have more money than Joe Blow over there has a dollar more than I do, therefore he sucks, and I hate him because he's a rich guy. And, you know, that's basically the template here. And the problem with that is that Obamacare has just – the full-blown Obamacare has just kicked in on January the 1st. Well, I mean, we are barely at the beginning of this whole train wreck. It's the tip of the iceberg, and – by the time that the midterm elections roll around in November, Obamacare is going to be front and center and in full blown in all of its glory, and we are not only going to see more people getting kicked off of their insurance plans, we're going to see a lot of people who lose their insurance plans through their employer. And so I think that try as they might, that Democrats are not going to completely get the conversation and get the discussion off of Obamacare, that the income inequality thing is not going to fly like they hope it will. But, it's like anything else. We will see what happens there with that. Also, earlier this week, in the latest issue of Rolling Stone magazine, I'll start here off the top of my head and say that I think that we are all well aware that Rolling Stone is no conservative rag. So maybe this is to be expected. There was an article here written by Jesse Meyerson in the latest issue of Rolling Stone magazine, and it's called Five Economic Reforms Millennials Should Be Fighting For. And a subtitle to that is Guaranteed Jobs, Universal Basic Income, which you can also translate to Universal Basic Outcome, Public Finance, and more. And there's five things here that when you hear this, I can tell you it's socialism, but I don't think I have to tell you. He says here that there's five things here that millennials should be fighting for. And the first one here is guaranteed work for everybody. And apparently, Jesse's favorite phrase here is that everything blows. Unemployment blows, capitalism blows, rich people blow, the economy still blows. Well, you get the picture. Jesse is suggesting here that everyone should have a guaranteed job, and I guess apparently that guaranteed job should include jobs like Walmart and McDonald's and Taco Bell, and that those people should, I'm sure, of course, make $15 an hour. He says a job guarantee that paid a living wage would anchor prices, drive up conditions for workers at mega corporations like Walmart and McDonald's, and target unemployment for the poor and long-term unemployed, people to whom conventional stimulus money rarely trickles all the way down. The program would automatically expand during private sector downturns and contract during private sector upswings, balancing out the business cycle and sending people from job to job rather than job to unemployment when times got tough. Well, the problem with that, Jesse, is that, this has been revisited time and again, I'm sure it will be again some more, is that when you pay people at McDonald's and Taco Bell $15 an hour, how much do you think that you're going to pay for that Big Mac? How much do you think that you're going to pay for that box of tacos? You're not going to pay $3.99 for it. You're not going to pay a dollar for that Big Mac. The prices are going to jump up. And not only are the prices going to jump up, but you're also going to hurt the very people that you're trying to help, because how many people do you think that McDonald's franchise can employ at $15 an hour? Let's say right now that they have 15 to 20 employees. That's going to be cut in half, if not more. And it's, I am certainly no economics major, but I don't understand why people don't get that. Some of the other things that Jesse likes here, well, we know that Jesse likes socialism. Social security for all. We should all, and actually even he says it too, he comes right out and says it, but let's think even bigger. Because as much as unemployment blows, so do jobs. What if people didn't have to work to survive? Enter the jaw-droppingly simple idea of a universal basic income in which the government would just add a sum sufficient for subsistence to everyone's bank account every month. A proposal along these lines has been gaining attraction in Switzerland, and it's starting to get a lot of attention here. I think a lot of us would be the first ones to stand up and say, yeah, you know what, hauling your sorry butt out of bed at 5 o'clock or 5:30 in the morning, you're right, it does blow. But, it's funny because he's proposing all of these different programs. I'm not even done yet. I've just rattled off two here. And all through this piece, he is kind of dumping on rich people and dumping on, what does he call them here, the infamous 1%. Well, newsflash, Jesse, but that infamous 1% are the people who are paying you. They're the people who are paying the Walmart employees. They're the people who are paying the McDonald's employees. And probably something maybe that Jesse doesn't know is that not every McDonald's, but a lot of them are franchises. They're independently owned by people who run them. And, you know, they're not going to be able to afford to pay one of your buddies $15 an hour to flip a burger. A couple of the other things here he has is take back the land. There should be no private ownership of land. And also, just getting back to the jobs thing from the guaranteed Social Security for all, you know, I think one of the biggest things you have to ask, you know, who does Jesse think is paying for this? Again, is it his hated 1%? Yeah, it is. Those are the people who are going to pay for all these programs that he thinks that we are all entitled to. And if you're getting it, here's another thing, too, that jumped out at me. If you're going to have the government just dump X number of dollars a month into your bank account, why do you need to be guaranteed a job? You know, if you don't want to work, if like you said, jobs blow, and yeah, like I just said, hauling your butt out of bed at 5 o'clock in the morning when it's 3 below 0, yeah, that completely sucks. I'll be the first one to stand up and admit that. But if you have the government dumping X number of dollars into your bank account every month, why do you need to do that? You can just sit around and, what does he say? I'm trying to find the phrases here that he was wording. That people couldn't just contribute the skills that inspire them. Teaching, tutoring, urban farming, cleaning up the environment, painting murals, rather than telemarketing or whatever other stupid tasks bosses need done to supplement their millions. Yeah, it does sound nice, Jesse, but I don't know what planet that is. If you find out, let me know, and I will certainly join you there. One of the other things here is make everything owned by everybody. So basically what he's advocating here is no private ownership of anything. And that, my friends, is a textbook definition of socialism. When the government owns every single entity in the nation, when they own all you have to do is take a look at Venezuela right now. The government is nationalizing everything. And when the government nationalizes every single industry, that's socialism. Let's see, what other things here? Oh, and last but certainly not least, a public bank in every state. Because, of course, you know, Wall Street blows too. There should be a state bank in every state. There's only one state right now that does do that, and that is North Dakota, which is really kind of ironic that he would mention North Dakota, because North Dakota has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the nation. When North Dakotans pay taxes, the money gets deposited in the state's bank, which in turn offers cheap loans to farmers, students, and businesses. The Bank of North Dakota doesn't make CD destined to default loans, slice them up inscrutably, and sell them on a secondary market. It doesn't play around with incomprehensible derivatives and allow its executives to extract billions of dollars. It just makes loans work with debtors to pay them off. Well, it's also interesting that you bring that point up, Jesse, because when the whole economic collapse happened in 2008, a lot of that was from no-fault loans, because there were Democrats and liberals in Congress who decided that owning a home was not a privilege, it was a right. And therefore, there were loans granted to people who were in no position to pay them off. And so that's what you had. And it's just, again, like I said before, it's one of the biggest things about this thing is I'm going to assume that Jesse Meyerson is 20-something, maybe 30-something. And the reason that Jesse Meyerson and people his age don't realize what this is when they read it is because, basically, is that if you are the product of the public school system, it wasn't taught to you. They don't teach what socialism and what communism is anymore. And so there's no way that Jesse and his friends, other people his age, would know that what he's describing basically is socialism. And if you look anywhere in the world at any place that socialism has been tried, it does not work. And so my advice to Jesse would be, you know, maybe you might take a little trip this summer. Why don't you plan your summer vacation? Plan that vacation in Cuba, or China, or better yet, take a lovely trip to Venezuela and see what the economy is like there this summer with the entire nation, with every industry in that nation industrialized, if not every single one, it's damn close to it. And let's come back and see what you think about that. Let's talk to the people who live there and see what they think about it, because you might be surprised at what you find. So anyway, there was Jesse, there was that. Another little tidbit that is going on this week, again, in Oklahoma. Oklahoma seems to be front and center this week, aside from New Jersey. One of the things that on right now in Oklahoma is, and I wrote about this this week over at Conservative Cauldron blog. Please go and read it, conservativecauldron.blogspot.com. There's a little shameless advertising. But there is a group of Satanists. It's a group based out of New York, and they are called the Satanic Temple. And basically what they want to do is they want to build a monument on the steps of the state capitol in Oklahoma City. And, well, you can imagine how in Oklahoma, you can imagine that well, it's not picking up the steam that the Satanist would hope that it would be picking up. If you go on Fox News and you click on this article, they have an artist rendering of what the monument would look like. And you know, before I'm called a hypocrite, like I said. On the blog that as a member of a minority faith, I'm uncomfortable criticizing anyone's religion because it can happen so easily to me. It can happen easily to any of us. But there's an artist's rendering here of the monument that they would like to put up. It is a picture of Satan with his horns and his wings and his whole, you know, paraphernalia, and he is sitting on a throne, and etched on that throne behind him is a giant inverted pentagram, which as a Wiccan, a pentagram is a symbol of my faith, not the inverted pentagram that Satanists use, a five-pointed star, basically. And so I'm a little bothered by that as a Wiccan that they take the symbol of my faith and they literally twist it and turn it upside down. So anyway, they have submitted an application for this monument to be on the steps of the state capitol. And I think what happened maybe is that they got this idea. There is a monument of the Ten Commandments on the north steps of the Oklahoma State Capitol. And the Satanic Temple, this group, their contention is that because the Ten Commandments statue is there, that it, quote, opens the doors, unquote, for other faiths and other religions to have a representation there. And right now, the Oklahoma chapter of the ACLU is fighting to have that Ten Commandments monument removed. I'm not sure. It does not say here who the ACLU is filed this lawsuit on behalf of. It is, to my knowledge, it is not the Satanic Temple. It's something completely different. And what the commission that the panel that takes these applications from these various groups and processes them. They are saying that they are going to hold off making any more applications for things of this nature until this lawsuit is settled. And of course, Oklahoma City is, you know, that's right in the heart. Oklahoma is a very conservative state, and a lot of times people. I've heard it called the buckle of the Bible Belt, and so like I said, I'm sure that this whole thing is going to go over like a lead balloon. I do have here, oh, this is Lucian Greaves. He is a spokesman for the Satanic Temple.
Finally revealed, a god figure with children at its feet. The monument the Satanic Temple hopes will soon sit at the state capitol.
We decided to go with that because it is a fairly traditional character. It also offers a lap that visitors can come to sit on, have their picture taken with.
The devil's image sitting beside the Ten Commandments. It's an odd pair, but Satanic Temple spokesperson Lucian Grief says the monuments together represent religious freedom. Not everyone agrees.
Well, I think they're trying to get our goat, and I'm not going to let them do that.
Representative Paul Wesselhoff believes the Satanic statue won't pass through the Preservation Committee.
What will disqualify them has really nothing to do with Satan as such. It's that it has no historical significance for the state of Oklahoma. The only reason why the Ten Commandments qualified is because at the Capitol what we do is we make laws. We are lawmakers. Well, one of the earliest laws that we have are the Ten Commandments. So therefore, it has historical significance.
But the Satanic Temple says its statue carries the same weight.
It absolutely is of historic value. Not only would a satanic monument send a clear and distinct message that America respects plurality, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, but it would also stand as a historical marker commemorating scapegoats, the marginalized, and the demonized minority, the unjustly outcast.
I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I am in full support of Satanists. I am not a Satanist. Wiccans and pagans are, some of them will call Satanists pagans, some will not. I do not feel that they are pagans. But like I said, basically over at conservativecauldron.blogspot.com, sometimes freedom and liberty are messy things, and bottom line is that maybe Satanism is not for you. But they have the right to believe the way they want to believe. They have the right to practice their faith the way they would like to. And, I doubt that anything will come of this either. They do say that they are halfway to the $20,000 that they need to build this monument. So we will see what happens there. But on a lighter note, I'd just like to share this with you. Dennis Rodman. We all who knew Dennis Rodman is, went to see his buddy Kim Jong-un on his birthday this week. And, well, he sang happy birthday to his buddy. Happy birthday, Kim. Have many more so that you can kill and maim and execute many more people. Happy birthday, buddy. Here's to you, your buddy, Dennis. On that note, I want to thank everyone for joining me tonight on the first hour-long, new and improved Conservative Cauldron Radio. Please join me next week. We will have plenty more to talk about. I'm sure that Traffic Gate will not be over, and there will be plenty of other loveliness to talk about. So please go to where it all began, theconservativecauldron.blogspot.com. Please check me out on Facebook at facebook.com/Becky Noble. You can find me on Twitter at Patriot Witch. Please go to examiner.com and watchdogwire.com for all of my writings there. I want to thank everybody for hanging out with me tonight. Thanks for chilling with me tonight. You are listening to Conservative Cauldron Radio. I'm Becky Noble, and I will see you next week. Bye.